May it please the court, I represent Tammy Watson, who is a production worker at a factory in Crawfordsville. Ms. Watson had worked in the plant for several years and in 1998 was injured on the job with an injury to her right arm and shoulder. She underwent some medical treatment provided by the company under the workers' compensation system. On several occasions, she would be treated, therapy, etc., released to go back to work, given the same temporary restrictions again until she had more therapy. And this repeated itself about three or four times until finally, in June of 98 or 99, she was placed on permanent restrictions. At the time that the permanent restrictions were assigned, then she was placed on indefinite layoff by the employer and then terminated at the end of 12 months, having not returned to work.
Mr. Eric, how can Ms. Watson prevail given the results in the Supreme Court's recent decision in Toyota Motor against Williams? I mean, what's really different, importantly, about her situation from the one that the court said wasn't enough to trigger ADA protection in Williams?
If it's the position you're talking about, in this case, Lithonia Lighting has over 500 production workers, and they are implying here or stating that every production worker must be able to do every job in the whole plant.
But why is that such a wild thing for an employer to say if on that particular work site or in that particular company needs vary on production lines, or maybe an ergonomic expert said, you know, people's muscles are less strained if they change jobs every few hours or every few days or whatever, or I can think of all kinds of reasons why an employer legitimately might say, when you come to work for us, you have to be able to perform whatever the number of lines is. You know, that looks like some 50 lines or something. I don't know, but it doesn't matter. I mean, I don't see why that's automatically some sort of suspect job requirement, especially given the deference in the law to the employer's own descriptions of essential job functions.
Well, in this case, of course, this is a TR-56 case, and I think the employer is not entitled to any deference in this case.
I mean, you would have to show some reason to think that the employer's description of its job description was not true.
We have that in this case.
Just because they accommodate people for temporary periods of time?
No, they accommodate people also for permanent periods of time, and also because the job description, which is the bulk of the evidence provided by
What is the evidence that they accommodated people permanently? I understand your client filed an affidavit, but that affidavit was all hearsay on this question.
That is the evidence followed by the response.
Is there any non-hearsay evidence?
There is not, but there is a response of the employer.
At the summary judgment stage, the evidence has to be what would be admissible at trial. Hearsay isn't admissible.
The employer did not deny that and, in fact, admitted it in his briefing.
He's not admitting it here. What do you
mean
by... He's
not admitting it now.
Yeah. Let's not say he admitted it. He acknowledged it and asked for credit for giving accommodation to more people than he would necessarily be required to give accommodation to. That's in the reply brief. So the employer said, well, yeah, we did it, but don't blame us for it. Reward us for it. And so we do have that, I think, as a factual scenario. As to the job description, the one that's in the record was actually made up after Ms. Watson's injuries, and if you look at that, nowhere in that job description does it say that everyone has to do repetitive motion.
Didn't she admit that? Didn't she say, yeah, we all move around in different lines? I thought there was a huge amount of evidence in the record that...
I'm talking about repetitive motion of a limb. There is evidence that there are 30-plus lines that people are normally assigned to a given line, and that within the line they rotate. There's no question she could rotate and did rotate regularly within at least three lines, even when she was working under her most severe restrictions. The other lines, some of them she could do the work, some of them she couldn't. But with that number of employees, certainly there's no reason to think that it's a necessity of the employer that Tammy Watson would have to go do work on a given line when there are at least four lines she can do work any time.
But that, of course, might not be the legal standard, and you've slipped away from Toyota. Why is there a major life activity that she is being prevented from, accomplishing?
First of all, she is affected in her work, and that is patent. By the way, the company handled this. What they did was,
is work alone enough after Toyota?
I think it probably is, but she has more than that. She also has testimony that affects her recreation, her ability to do things at home, her personal hygiene, those sorts of things, and that's in the record. So she has the scope of the Toyota symptoms, but in my view, the more serious thing is that the employer definitely viewed her as disabled, because it went to page 25 or 26 of the union contract, which said people who are disabled, if they ask for leave, can be given a leave. They misconstrued that and misapplied it and said you must take a leave instead of allowing her to ask for it. But clearly they treated her as disabled and felt she was. That is a set of facts that are related to or referred to in Ms. Shaw's deposition, her affidavit, she being the human resources person. And in that affidavit, she denies, for instance, that there was any information or belief on her part that Tammy Watson suffered in any way from a disability, et cetera. And that, I think, is patently false, and that is the one of the components that create the responsive evidence to their claim, this is the description. That's not the description. And the fact that she, in her affidavit, could be shown and by their own evidence to be providing false evidence could be taken by a jury as evidence of mendacity, and then we get into the Reeves, et cetera, effect on the general outcome. I think Reeves is particularly appropriate when looking at this case because the employer has submitted its position or its definition of what it claims the jobs are, but the jobs it claims are not jobs. The job description is not a description of a job. It is a description of all the work maximum that must be performed in the plant by any number of people. A job, as I understand it, and even as Lithonia really understands it, is on line number 8, what do you do? And what do you do on first position, second position, third position, fourth position? And certainly a job would be line 8, at most, or the components of line 8 if you rotate among them. On line 8 and on two or three other lines, she was certified to be capable of doing that work by Lithonia's own physical therapist who was brought in during the time that she was on temporary restriction. The crux of this, I think, in terms of Lithonia's approach is that a worker on temporary restriction, if they let them go home or send them home, must be paid workers' comp benefits. If they keep them at work, of course they keep them at work and they just pay them their wage. The day they receive permanent restrictions, they're no longer eligible for workers' comp benefits if they send them home, so they send them home. And I think the effect of this, whether the court feels that this is an intentional scheme to get around the...
I don't see what that has to do with federal law. It sounds like you're complaining about a misuse of the state workers' compensation system. But you're
no,
in the wrong court for that.
No, I don't intend to do that. What I intend to show is that there is plenty of accommodation in that plant, and they accommodate every day. when it costs them something, when it might cost them something, but they refuse to accommodate.
The alternative way to understand this is that so long as restrictions are temporary, people are accommodated in the hope of bringing them back to regular full-time positions. And as soon as it becomes clear that that can't happen, they no longer use those positions to try to work them back into the regular workforce.
The regular full-time positions here are what she worked at. Each one of these positions is a regular full-time position. The only choice in the HR department when someone shows up with restrictions is whether they're going to be assigned to a regular job, a regular position on a regular line, instead of another one.
And okay, thank you, Mr. Ayers. Mr. Mazur?
May it please the court, my name is Jim Mazur. I'm from Indianapolis. Lock Reynolds is my law firm, and I'm here on behalf of Lithonia Lighting. The one thing I do have to clarify that Mr. Ayers said, there is no admission that I made on behalf of my client with respect to any accommodations. There's no evidence in the record of any prior accommodations. There is a footnote that I dropped in the brief to this court that indicates that even if Lithonia had made an accommodation, they shouldn't be penalized for doing a good deed. But that's as far as it goes. As far as the plaintiff's and appellant's assessment of her own disability being substantially limited in her major life activities apart from the workplace, she offered an affidavit. That's all there is. I dare say that Mr. Ayers is not aware of this court's decision from last March in Klein versus Ashcroft, 284 F3rd 721, which says specifically that is not enough. This court, in fact, interpreted the Toyota decision, the Williams versus Toyota decision of the Supreme Court in assessing that particular individual's substantial limitation or lack thereof. Here, there were at least five grounds on which summary judgment would have been appropriate under this court's Bedford Park decision. Any of those decisions, of course, is sufficient. The job description that Mr. Ayers disparages here before us today, unfortunately for his client, was buttressed by his own client's testimony. There is a plethora of evidence that indicates she worked not only every job in the plant, but she went basically from working one slot for an hour and a half, one slot for another hour and a half, one slot for another hour and a half, throughout the course of a single day, and several times a week she went from position to position, line to line.
So she not only went from position to position within a line, she went from line to line.
That's correct.
And others were required to do the same.
That's right. And her testimony is quoted verbatim in my brief. And I think that's the crux of it here. I think this court picked up on the fact that Lithonia did that for ergonomic reasons. There wasn't a nefarious motive to exit this employee. In fact, looking at just the basic facts, she had temporary restrictions. The company took her and put her in cobbled together positions, if you will, that were within those restrictions until there was such a time that she was permanently restricted from doing any repetitive motion. And in her answers to interrogatories, in her statement to her own union representative at the EEOC while she was there on behalf of some other employee, in fact, she said, "I'm never going to be able to do any repetitive motion work." Well, that's all there is in a production facility like Lithonia Lighting, is repetitive motion, or I should say that's the vast majority of activities that employees engage in. In the final analysis, Your Honors, what we have here is a case where you're faced with the question of, can an employer establish essential functions of a job, or may an employee pick among a smorgasbord of activities that are in every kind of manufacturing facility, such as Lithonia Lighting? I think the obvious answer under the case law is that the employer establishes the essential functions of the job. Secondly, another question that this course is faced with here today is, can an employer make a series of intermittent temporary assignments without converting them into a permanent position? I think the obvious answer to that is yes, under the applicable law governing the ADA. And then, thirdly, I think the only other item for this court's consideration based on the plaintiff's and the appellant's assessment of the issues before the court is, does the prior assignment of any kind of worker, the prior assessment, perception by this particular worker that somebody else has received some sort of accommodation or placement within a job that would fit her particular responsibilities, thereby require the employer to establish a new job? And obviously I think the answer to that is no. I don't have any more for this court, and I appreciate your attentiveness.
Thank you, Mr. Mazur. And Mr. Ayers, your time had expired, so we thank both counsel. And our last case for argument, United States.